This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with The Week magazine of April 24th. Iran vows retaliation after U.S. blockades ports. President Trump declared that the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran was very close to over, even as he ordered a naval blockade of Iranian ports, and Tehran threatened to strike back by attacking shipping routes across the Middle East. The blockade is intended to force Tehran to accept terms after direct talks between U.S. and Iranian officials in Pakistan ended without a deal to halt the conflict or to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, a Persian Gulf waterway that carried a fifth of the world's oil before it was closed by Iran during the war. Vessels attempting to access or leave Iran's ports will face interception, diversion, and capture, said U.S. Central Command. More than 15 U.S. warships and 100 aircraft are enforcing the blockade, which turned back 9 vessels, at least 5 of which were carrying oil, in its first 48 hours. Another 10,000 troops are expected to arrive in the region over the next 2 weeks. Iran warned that if the blockade continues, it will halt all marine traffic in the Persian Gulf, Sea of Oman, and Red Sea, and strike ports and other targets across the region. Trump said if Iran escalated, we could take out every one of their power plants in an hour. We don't want to do that. Meanwhile, Pakistani mediators worked to extend a 2-week ceasefire due to end April 22nd and to restart talks. Vice President J.D. Vance, who led the U.S. delegation in Islamabad, said the sticking point was Iran's refusal to end its nuclear program. Vance proposed a 20-year moratorium on uranium enrichment, multiple outlets reported. Iran countered with 5 years. We've made very clear what our red lines are, said Vance. The U.S. announced that Israel and Lebanon had agreed to begin direct negotiations to end fighting between Israel and the Iran-backed militia Hezbollah, which threatened to derail the ceasefire. Trump, who attended an Ultimate Fighting Championship match in Miami during the negotiations, said he was confident the economic pressure generated by the blockade would force Tehran to open the Strait of Hormuz and agree to never have a nuclear weapon. Trump said other nations would join the U.S. flotilla, but none did, and some pointedly refused. The blockade makes no sense, said Spanish Defense Minister Margarita Robles. Since this war started, nothing makes sense. Vance's failure to reach a deal was inevitable, said Fred Kaplan in Slate. Such negotiations can take months, not the 21 hours he spent at the table. And we sent 3 envoys, Vance, the president's son-in-law Jared Kushner, and special envoy Steve Witkoff, with no deep grasp of nuclear issues or experience at real diplomacy. Iran has expressed willingness to restrict uranium enrichment to 1.5% purity. Weapons grade is 90%. That's an opening for deal-making, but instead, Vance walked. It's clear Trump, who's deluded enough to think he's winning, didn't want a deal that required any U.S. compromise. Iran wasn't about to crack either, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. It took Trump's eagerness for a ceasefire as a sign of desperation and confirmation it has the upper hand. The resulting U.S. blockade makes sense as long as Trump is willing to accept the energy market pain that's coming. Iran's economy will buckle from the collapse of oil exports, the main revenue source of the regime. It now has an incentive to fully reopen the Strait of Hormuz, as does China, whose tankers had been given priority. The blockade is a throwdown the U.S. can't win, said Mark Champion in Bloomberg. Trump wants to squeeze Tehran without escalating the war, but that works only if you believe the mullahs will fold under the resulting economic pressure before Trump does. In reality, the regime has the whip hand because it is willing to inflict more economic pain on its populace than Trump, whose approval rating is falling as the war's shockwaves hit home. Iran's parliamentary speaker warned Americans this week they'd soon be nostalgic for $4 to $5 gas. Overwhelmingly skeptical of the war, Americans have no stomach for sacrifice, said Martha McHardy in the Daily Beast. In a new Ipsos poll, only 24% of voters said the war has been worth the cost, and 60% oppose it. In dozens of interviews on the war with voters in military towns, many expressed anger, frustration, even bewilderment, said Jack Healy in the New York Times. Some are baffled about what Trump, who vowed to keep the U.S. out of wars, wants to achieve in a conflict he did not prepare them for. Meanwhile, enforcing the blockade could put American service members at risk, said Bryn Tannehill in The Atlantic. Vessels trying to evade it might hug Iran's shoreline, exposing responding U.S. ships to missile and drone attacks. If a vessel refuses to stop, the Navy will have to decide whether to order search and seizure teams to board without cooperation, a risky venture, or to disable the vessel by firing on it. And what will happen if that ship is Chinese? 7 weeks into Trump's war, things are looking bad, said Ryan Evans in War on the Rocks. And it's hard to see how the path ahead gets much better. The strait is shut, energy markets are in turmoil, a hardline regime remains in charge in Tehran, and its battered forces remain capable of waging warfare. This is what happens when you blunder into a war with no coherent political objective and then mistake tactical success for victory. Negotiations may continue, but Trump must realize he's not a victor imposing terms. Until he does, we aren't just walking the path to defeat. We are blindly sprinting down it. MAGA takes a hit as Hungary's Orbán voted out. Hungarian voters booted out their longtime Prime Minister Viktor Orbán in a general election, dealing a blow to the European far right and robbing the Trump administration of its biggest cheerleader in the EU. Though the Kremlin-friendly Orbán had held power for the past 16 years, partly by tilting the electoral system in his favor, his far-right Fidesz party lost to the center-right Tisza party of anti-corruption campaigner Peter Magyar. With turnout at a record 80%, Magyar took a two-thirds parliamentary majority, which will allow him to undo the changes Orbán made to Hungary's courts, elections, and press that had restricted the country's democratic freedoms. While Orbán had been expected to cry fraud if he lost, the trouncing was too complete. Instead, he conceded quickly as pro-Magyar crowds celebrated across the country. Magyar pledged to work more closely with the EU and NATO and restore checks and balances. Together we liberated Hungary and took back our country, he told cheering supporters. Those who commit the sin of dividing the nation must leave power. Ahead of the vote, the Trump administration had made a show of supporting Orbán, and with Vice President J.D. Vance visiting Budapest to campaign with him. President Trump even called in to a rally to praise Orbán's anti-immigrant policies. I love Viktor, he said. He didn't allow people to storm your country. Russia, too, had an interest in keeping Orbán in power, as he had consistently advanced Kremlin aims by blocking EU aid to Ukraine and vetoing EU sanctions on Moscow. This is not just a repudiation of Russian influence, said Ian Bremmer, head of the risk advisory firm Eurasia Group. It's also a repudiation of Trump. Why was the White House so invested in seeing Orbán prevail? Asked Nick Catoggio in the Dispatch, because MAGA elites looked to his illiberal Christian democracy as a model, even holding an annual conservative confab in Budapest. Orbán was the Your Trump who proved back in 2010 that voters would flock to an anti-immigrant and culturally reactionary strongman. And crucially, he showed that such a person could entrench power by packing courts with loyalists, handing the press over to friendly oligarchs, and rigging the election system for his own party. Yet, eventually, Orban forgot a basic rule of politics, said Andrew Higgins in the New York Times. A populist must actually be popular to win elections. But as Hungary's economy became deformed by corruption, voters grew angry. Hungary today has the slowest growth in the region, and unemployment is at a 10-year high. In the end, even Orban's near total control of the media, which effectively barred Magyar from TV during the entire campaign, was no match for reality. That's why Fidesz's shellacking could be an omen for Trump's MAGA movement, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. Like Orban, Trump presides over flagrant corruption while inflation is rising and economic growth slowing. He could face a similar smackdown in the November midterm elections. That would be more likely if Democrats were to follow Magyar's script, said William A. Galston in the Wall Street Journal. The Hungarian challenger's disciplined and energetic campaign focused on bread and butter issues, cronyism and corruption, economic stagnation and inflation, and decaying public services. Wisely, he avoided discussing divisive social issues or attacking his opponent as an enemy of democracy. Don't read too much into Orban's defeat, said Jamie Detmer in Politico. Sure, it's tempting to see Hungary's result as a symbolic setback for populists everywhere, especially given the effort that Trump and Vance have put into juicing far-right European parties. Yet, elections reflect local political and economic circumstances much more often than broad and lasting transnational trends. This vote in a nation of only 10 million isn't a devastating blow to the far right, not in Europe and not in the U.S. Perhaps not, said Anne Applebaum in The Atlantic, but it does show that illiberalism is not inevitable. There's been a belief within the MAGA movement, one that's also present in Russian President Vladimir Putin's rhetoric, that it and its international brethren are somehow destined not just to win, but to hold power forever because they have the support of the real people. But that's no longer the case. Hungary showed that real people grow tired of their rulers. Old ideas become stale. Younger people question orthodoxy. If Orban can lose, so too can his Russian and American admirers. Trump versus Leo, why the president took on the Pope. A countdown began as soon as the Chicago-born Robert Prevost was elected Pope last year, said Nick Catoggio in the Dispatch. President Trump was never going to let another American challenge his moral leadership, so it was only a matter of when, not if, he'd pick a fight with the new pontiff. That moment arrived last week after Pope Leo XIV denounced Trump's genocidal threat to end Iran's whole civilization as truly unacceptable. Trump shot back with a post accusing Leo of being weak on crime, terrible for foreign policy, and catering to the radical left. 46 minutes later, for good pope-baiting measure, Trump posted an AI-generated image of himself as a robed Jesus, bathed in golden holy light, miraculously healing a bed-bound man. Even for many MAGA diehards, this blasphemous image was too much, said Jeffrey Blahar in National Review. Trump later deleted it, claiming he thought it depicted him as a doctor. But he doubled down on his criticism of Leo and was joined by Vice President J.D. Vance, a Catholic convert, who advised the Pope to be careful when talking about theology. For an unpopular administration embroiled in several other global messes, this seems like an odd moment to declare a MAGA fatwa on the leader of the planet's 1.4 billion Catholics, among them 20% of U.S. citizens. Did Trump pick this fight, or did Leo?" asked Paul Ely in The New Yorker. Vatican Convention holds that the Pope should be neutral in international conflicts, but on Palm Sunday he said God rejects the prayers of those with hands full of blood, a clear shot at the crusaderish rhetoric of Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, an evangelical Protestant who recently called on Almighty God to grant U.S. forces overwhelming violence of action against those who deserve no mercy. And last week, Leo referenced Trump by name for the first time, calling on the president to find an off-ramp in Iran. "This spat didn't start with Iran," said Kira Butler in Mother Jones. Leo also criticized Trump's immigration crackdown and his January raid on Venezuela, and channeled the mounting anger of many Catholics over Israel's brutal campaign in Gaza. With the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran, that frustration turned to opposition, and the war is now tearing apart the Catholic evangelical coalition that elected Trump. "He had hoped to forge a special bond with an American pontiff," said Mattia Fararesi in the Free Press. After all, the president gave the Supreme Court a Catholic supermajority, and his administration has a striking number of Catholic top officials. But relations with the Vatican have instead deteriorated so severely that during an unusual January meeting at the Pentagon with the Holy See's U.S. ambassador, one U.S. official reportedly invoked the Avignon papacy, a period in the 1300s when the French crown used its military might to dominate the papal authority. "Leo's not looking for a fight with Trump," said David Gibson in the New York Times. "He's looking past him. A fit 70-year-old with a lifetime appointment, Leo sees it as his mission to shape the post-Trump global order and help Catholics rediscover the virtues of peace, compassion, and common decency over jingoist bullying. Leo's quiet, confident witness is already resonating with American Catholics," said Gustavo Arellano in the Los Angeles Times, giving them the courage to reject Trump's cruelty and selfishness. Pope Leo declared that he has no fear of the Trump administration, and we shouldn't either. Washington, D.C., cleaning house. Facing mounting accusations of sexual misconduct, two members of Congress resigned before the House could vote to expel them. Representative Eric Swalwell, Democrat of California, a leading Democratic candidate for governor of California, suspended his campaign and stepped down from the House after his colleagues launched an ethics investigation into accusations of sexual abuse, including rape, by at least five women. CNN and the San Francisco Chronicle published accounts from four women who accused Swalwell, a married father of three, of a range of misconduct, including sending unsolicited photos of his penis. One former staffer said they had sex when she wasn't able to consent. Another woman, Lana Drews, later came forward and said he'd drugged and then raped and choked her in 2018. Other women said he was creepy and were warned to stay away. Swalwell, 45, apologized for his mistakes in judgment, but pledged to fight these serious false accusations. Democratic leaders professed shock about the allegations. "He's lived a double life," said Arizona Senator Ruben Gallego. Representative Tony Gonzalez, Republican of Texas, also resigned this week after a House ethics investigation into his relationship with a staffer who committed suicide last year. Another former employee said he sent her explicit messages and repeatedly asked for sex and nude photos. The bipartisan outrage over Swalwell and Gonzalez revived scrutiny of other lawmakers entangled in ethics scandals. Representative Corey Mills, Republican of Florida, stands accused of sexual misconduct, and his ex-girlfriend has a protective order against him. A House probe found Representative Sheila Cherfulis McCormick, Democrat of Florida, guilty of using COVID relief funds for her 2022 campaign. Time for some House cleaning, said Representative Nancy Mace, Republican of South Carolina. Atlanta, vaccine report withheld. The acting director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention delayed releasing a report on the effectiveness of the COVID-19 vaccine, the Washington Post reported. The study, scheduled for publication on March 19th, had already cleared the agency's scientific review process, but then-acting CDC Director Jay Bhattacharya held up publication over concerns about the methodology, scientists said, even though the same methodology had been used by the CDC and top medical journals to evaluate vaccine effectiveness for decades. The move has bolstered suspicions among scientists that information about COVID shots is being limited by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a vocal vaccine skeptic. The report showed that healthy adults who received the COVID shot were 55% less likely to be hospitalized last winter, and emergency room visits decreased by 50% compared with those who did not. Boston, judicial purge. Two judges who ruled against the Trump administration in the deportation cases of pro-Palestinian student activists were fired by the Justice Department, the New York Times reported. Rupal Patel and Nina Froese oversaw the high-profile cases against Rumeysa Ozturk and Mohsen Madawi, both of whom were arrested by Immigration and Customs Enforcement last year as part of a string of detainments of students who had publicly supported Palestinian causes or took part in campus demonstrations. Patel ruled in January that there were no grounds to deport Ozturk, a Tufts University student from Turkey. Froese came to a similar conclusion about Madawi, a Palestinian at Columbia University. The Trump administration has dismissed more than 100 judges in recent months in an overhaul of the immigration courts and threatened others with disciplinary action if they don't deport more people, a Times investigation found. All of us are looking over our shoulders, said Holly DeAndrea, an immigration judge in Texas. Washington, D.C., seditious reversal. Federal prosecutors moved to erase the seditious conspiracy convictions of far-right agitators who helped orchestrate the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, escalating the Trump administration's efforts to rewrite the story of the 2020 election and its violent aftermath. Jeanine Pirro, the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, asked an appeals court to vacate the convictions of 12 members of the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, including the latter's founder, Stuart Rhodes, who was sentenced to 18 years after prosecutors said he stockpiled guns in a hotel for quick reaction force teams. President Trump last year cleared over 1,500 people of charges connected to the riot, but only commuted the sentences of Rhodes and 13 other defendants, leaving the convictions on their records. One was already pardoned, and another had his conviction dismissed. Pirro's request would scrub away the rest. The Hague, Netherlands. Royals criticized. King Willem-Alexander, Queen Maxima, and Prime Minister Rob Jetten drew intense criticism for their visit to the White House to dine with President Trump. The royals even stayed the night in the residence, a rare invitation. The Dutch opposition said the visit amounted to support of Trump, who has threatened to quit NATO and wipe out a whole civilization in Iran. Jetten shrugged off the rebuke. You have to ask yourself to what extent it makes a difference if a small country like the Netherlands says, "We're not coming," Jetten said. Showing up and having a serious conversation is more useful. Kyiv, robot victory. Ukrainian forces have for the first time retaken territory from Russian control using only ground robots and aerial drones without infantry involvement and without losses on our side, President Volodymyr Zelensky said. Faced with the unmanned weapons, the Russians surrendered, he said. Ukraine has used drones and robots in 22,000 frontline missions in the past 3 months, both for assaults and to retrieve wounded troops from the battlefield. The weapons are typically controlled by humans from a safe distance, but Ukraine is also developing combat robots that will kill enemy soldiers without human input. The future is already on the front lines, Zelensky told Ukrainian defense workers, and Ukraine is building it. Beirut. Israel keeps bombing. Israeli forces pounded Hezbollah strongholds in southern Lebanon, killing 13 people a day after the first direct diplomatic talks between Israel and Lebanon since 1993. More than 2,100 Lebanese, including at least 172 children, have been killed in the 6 weeks of conflict, which began when Hezbollah fired rockets into Israel to protest Israeli attacks on Hezbollah's sponsor, Iran. A single 10-minute barrage last week killed more than 300 people, many in densely populated Beirut. Firas Abiad, a surgeon and former health minister, said Israel was also targeting ambulances and medical personnel. Beijing. EU wants China's help. Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez made his fourth visit to China in 3 years in a bid to strengthen European relations with Beijing. Sanchez said China should assume a bigger role on climate change, security, and other issues as the U.S. retreats from its global role. China can do more, Sanchez said, for example, by demanding that international law be respected and that the conflicts in Lebanon, Iran, Gaza, and the West Bank and Ukraine cease. Chinese President Xi Jinping, meanwhile, said Sanchez was valued as a crucial liaison between China and the EU, and he promised China would reject the world's return to the law of the jungle. In an apparent reference to Sanchez's refusal to let the U.S. use Spanish airspace or bases for the Iran war, Xi called him an example of moral rectitude. Tehran, Supreme Leader disfigured. Iran's Supreme Leader, Mojtaba Khamenei, suffered severe injuries to his face and may have lost a leg in the early airstrikes of the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran, three sources in his inner circle confirmed to Reuters. All three said his face was disfigured, and while they did not provide detail on the wounds to his leg, Iranian newscasters have referred to him as a Janbaz, which can mean someone maimed in war. Still, the sources said Khamenei remains mentally sharp and in charge, saying he had been directing the peace negotiations with the Trump administration from an undisclosed location via audio conferencing. Khamenei was named leader by the Assembly of Experts, Iran's top clerical body, after the initial strikes killed his father, Ali Khamenei, the previous supreme leader. People. Lane's unwanted outing. Nathan Lane was utterly unprepared for a spotlight to be shown on his sexuality, said Juan A. Ramirez in The Guardian of the UK. A Broadway stalwart since the early 1980s, Lane rocketed to Hollywood fame after being cast as a drag queen in 1996's The Birdcage. While promoting the movie, he and Robin Williams, who played his on-screen partner, sat for an interview with Oprah Winfrey, who asked Lane if he feared being typecast as gay and people forever saying, "Are you? Are you not?" Lane had come out to friends and family decades earlier, but the idea of announcing he was gay on national TV left him lost for words and visibly uncomfortable. "In those days," he says, "you might as well say, 'And by the way, I love cock.' I wasn't ready. I wasn't brave enough." Williams stepped in to redirect the line of questioning, a move Lane, 70, attributes to the late actor's incredibly kind, generous soul. He holds no grudges against Winfrey, who he thinks was just being playful. But he recalls how a few weeks after the interview, he was stuck in Manhattan traffic when another driver spotted him and shouted, "Hey, faggot! Hey, faggot!" It was humiliating. I went, well, this is the other side of fame. Lane came out publicly in a magazine profile a few years later, but by that point it was like, yeah, big deal, we already knew. So there was no winning that one. Troubled pop star Britney Spears has voluntarily checked herself into rehab for substance abuse, her rep confirmed. A source close to Spears, 44, told the New York Post that her arrest last month on a DUI charge in California was a wake-up call. This is something she really wants to do for herself, said the source. She's dedicated to working on her health. It's unclear how long Spears will remain at the facility. The insider noted only that this isn't for a set 30 or 60-day program. It will take as long as she needs. Just hours before she entered rehab, Spears posted an Instagram video of herself gyrating to the Cardi B song, I Like It. The singer, wearing a sheer black bodysuit, red bolero hat, and knee-high boots, shimmied and slapped her own butt as she showed off her bare back. Cuba goes dark. The U.S. oil blockade is pushing the island and its communist regime to the brink of collapse. What's the situation in Cuba? The country is running out of fuel, and fast. Oil shipments from Venezuela, Cuba's main fuel supplier for the last three decades, ended in January after the U.S. attacked the South American country and captured its president, Nicolas Maduro. President Trump then declared a full oil blockade, threatening severe tariffs on any country that sent Cuba fuel. The blockade has exacerbated a long simmering economic and humanitarian crisis for Cuba's 11 million people. Blackouts of up to 20 hours are routine and their consequences are severe. Running water has been cut off in many urban areas because the systems rely on electric pumps. Trash has piled up for lack of gas to run garbage trucks, and doctors say preventable deaths are rising as equipment fails. In late March, the U.S. Coast Guard allowed a single Russian oil tanker carrying about 730,000 barrels of oil to pass through the blockade, providing Cuba with, at best, a few weeks of fuel. It's not going to have an impact. Cuba is finished, Trump said, and whether or not they get a boat of oil, it's not going to matter. How did Cuba get here? The island has been under U.S. sanctions for nearly seven decades. What began with an arms embargo during the Cuban Revolution in 1958 was broadened into a full trade and travel embargo after Fidel Castro established his communist government. While Castro's rule saw an expansion of access to education and health care, alongside those gains came political repression and the confiscation and nationalization of private land, businesses, and homes, prompting millions of Cubans to flee. The U.S. trade embargo, the longest in modern history, intensified Cuba's chronic economic woes, which deepened after the collapse in 1991 of its main foreign backer, the Soviet Union. The Cold War era embargo continued until the second term of President Barack Obama, who sought to ease what he called a rigid policy that is rooted in events that took place before most of us were born. What did Obama do? Believing a rapprochement could reduce repression on the island and provide economic opportunities for ordinary Cubans, he opened discussions in 2014 with Raul Castro, Fidel's brother and successor. The Obama administration restored diplomatic relations and struck Cuba from its list of state sponsors of terrorism. In March 2016, Obama became the first U.S. president to set foot in Cuba since Calvin Coolidge in 1928. Americans were allowed to travel to Cuba for educational purposes for the first time in decades, and direct commercial flights resumed and embassies opened. Cuba's tourism revenue jumped 15% in the first half of 2016, and a record 4 million foreigners visited that year. But few Cubans reaped benefits as increased demand for food and poor planning caused shortages and price hikes. "It's a disaster," said Lisette Felipe, a government-employed air conditioner seller in 2016. "We never lived luxuriously, but the comfort we once had doesn't exist anymore." Why didn't the thaw last? On the campaign trail in 2016, Trump pledged to undo Obama's policies, promises that helped him win the votes of a majority of Cuban Americans in Florida. In office, he imposed a maximum pressure campaign against Cuba and put the country back on the list of state sponsors of terrorism. Though President Joe Biden reversed that move in his last week in office in January 2025, Trump quickly reimposed it after returning to the White House last year with a newfound interest in Latin America, heavily influenced by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, a foreign policy hawk and the son of Cuban immigrants. Trump's first target was Venezuelan autocrat Maduro, a close ally of Cuba, and many Cuban Americans saw that intervention as a step toward realizing Rubio's desire to topple the island's communist government. "If I lived in Havana and I was in the government, I'd be concerned at least a little bit," Rubio warned hours after the January raid that captured Maduro. What does the White House want? The end of Cuba's communist government. The Trump administration has been negotiating with President Miguel Díaz-Canel's regime and seems inclined to avoid using military force, hoping the blockade will inspire Cubans to rise up against their government. Protests are spreading, with furious residents banging pots and chanting, "We've had enough! Freedom! And put the lights back on!" In the central city of Morón last month, protesters set the Communist Party's local headquarters on fire, the biggest show of dissent in years. But the blockade is also inflicting pain on ordinary Cubans. "The U.S. is trying to punish the Cuban government," said one Havana resident, "but it's the people who are suffering." How do Cubans feel about the blockade? They're desperate. In a country where the official average monthly wage is about $15, gas is now nearly $40 a gallon, if you can find it. There were three major blackouts in March, and the United Nations has warned the blockade will result in a severe humanitarian crisis, with fuel shortages hitting every aspect of the island's food system, from irrigation and harvesting to refrigeration and distribution. Health experts predict diseases such as dengue and chikungunya will return. Cuba's once vaunted health system is collapsing. There's little fuel for ambulances, doctors and nurses are unable to commute to work, and pharmacy shelves are bare. Many refrigerated medicines spoil when the power goes out. Doctors say premature births are increasing as an antibiotic shortage leads to rising infections. It's also getting harder to administer chemotherapy amid blackouts, and patients on ventilators now rely on backup batteries or hand pumps. "I don't know how long we can keep going," said Zenia Alvarez, whose 21-year-old son's lungs can't pump air on their own. His life depends on electricity. Best columns of the U.S. Why Israel is losing U.S. support. "Israel is winning wars," said Matt Lewis in The Hill, "but it is losing something just as important, the American public." A new Pew Research Center survey found that 60% of Americans view the Jewish state unfavorably, up from 53% in just a year. Hamas's October 7, 2023 massacre of 1,200 Israelis created sympathy for Israel that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu squandered with a hyper-aggressive response, including the killing of thousands of civilians in Gaza, Iran, and Lebanon. Netanyahu's bromance with President Trump has pushed mainstream Democrats away from Israel, and the two countries' joint war in Iran has left many non-interventionist Republicans feeling betrayed. It won't help that the New York Times revealed that Netanyahu secretly came to Washington to persuade Trump to go to war with Iran. Netanyahu painted an overly optimistic picture, telling Trump a bombing campaign would be quick and decisive, leaving Iran ripe for regime change and incapable of retaliating or closing the Strait of Hormuz. Trump's own advisors told him the Israeli scenario was farcical, but he bought it. Trump is responsible for his own decisions, but if this messy war drags on, public anger will grow, a flashing warning sign for Israel. Best Columns International. How they see us. Nobody trusts America now. Donald Trump's war on Iran has been madness from the start, said Mahfouz Anam in the Daily Star of Bangladesh. He apparently expected Iran to crumble after the first wave of U.S. and Israeli bombardment. When the regime kept fighting, attacking America's Gulf allies and shutting down the Strait of Hormuz oil gateway, Trump went berserk. He first pledged to eradicate all the country's power plants and bridges, a probable war crime, then vowed to destroy Iran's whole civilization, an utterly unacceptable threat that revolted the entire world. Yet all this bombing and genocidal posturing did was wreak havoc on global energy markets, making countries that had nothing to do with the conflict suffer immensely. Because of Trump's war, Bangladesh will see a slowdown in GDP growth this year that will erase 600,000 jobs and prevent 1.2 million people from rising out of poverty. Worst of all, neither we nor any other people can feel safe with such an amoral narcissist as U.S. president. As long as Trump remains in power, we are all on the brink of a nuclear catastrophe that could lead to World War III. This is no longer the United States that Australia has long, maybe too long, looked to for security, said Geraldine Brooks in The Age of Australia. Under Trump, America is a dangerous, destabilizing force. This is a man who can threaten all 93 million Iranians with genocide mere weeks after promising them help. If we remain allied with the U.S., Trump will suck us into future wars we should have no part of. It's time to rethink that alliance. South Korea is also reconsidering its dependence on America, said Hank Yore of South Korea in an editorial. Since Trump threatened to quit NATO merely because its members refused to join his offensive war, what's to say he won't abandon us too? The foundation of the peace and prosperity we have enjoyed is being shaken. What a bitter irony, said Matthew von Rohr in Der Spiegel of Germany. Trump came to power obsessed with the decline of America, yet he's actually managed to accelerate that decline. He has tossed aside the alliances that sustained America's power for decades and depleted American military might by squandering huge quantities of weapons on a doomed war against Iran. This is what you get, said Andrew Coyne in the Globe and Mail of Canada, when you hand the keys to the world's most powerful military to an insecure, deeply ignorant, endlessly manipulable, pathological narcissist. Iran has called his bluff. Where once we feared that Trump's America had become a predatory hegemon, now we wonder whether it is any sort of hegemon at all. Sure, the U.S. military can bomb anything with great precision, and that's impressive. But it can't change the geographic reality that Iran, with its seemingly endless supply of low-cost drones, can close the Strait of Hormuz at will. Trump has both shattered America's credibility as an ally and destroyed its reputation as a military superpower. No one trusts it. No one will work with it. Worst of all, after this, fewer will even be afraid of it. Trump, why even old allies are questioning his sanity. Every day and every week, it becomes more alarmingly evident that in the White House, a mad king reigns virtually unchecked, said Jackie Calmes in the Los Angeles Times. Since he launched the frustrating war in Iran, President Trump has reversed and contradicted himself repeatedly about its goals, while descending into enraged, profanity-flecked threats of genocide. On Easter Sunday, with Iran defying his demands to open the Strait of Hormuz to oil tankers, our commander-in-chief posted on Truth Social, "Open the fucking strait, you crazy bastards, or you'll be living in hell." He threatened to completely destroy Iran's power plants, bridges, and infrastructure, leaving 93 million Iranians without electricity, running water, or functioning hospitals, and followed 2 days later with this genocidal vow: "A whole civilization will die tonight." In everything the nearly 80-year-old Trump does, he shows the world he is mentally unstable, unfit for the office. When Pope Leo XIV criticized the war in Iran and Trump's brutal immigration roundups, Trump posted that the pontiff was weak on crime and terrible for foreign policy before following up with an AI-generated image of himself as a robed Jesus Christ healing a sick man, later claiming it depicted him as a doctor. "That was too much even for one-time acolytes," said McKenna Kelly and David Gilbert in Wired. Former Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene and podcasters Tucker Carlson and Alex Jones, among others, denounced Trump's depiction of himself as the Messiah and called for him to be removed from office, with Greene suggesting that Trump may actually be the Antichrist. Green told former MAGA allies, "I know all of you and him, and he has gone insane, and all of you are complicit." "It's no longer just Democrats and late-night comics questioning Trump's sanity," said Peter Baker in the New York Times. "Retired generals, former Republican officials, and foreign leaders are expressing deep concern about the state of mind of the oldest president ever inaugurated." In his second term, Trump seems even less restrained and more incoherent, publicly using profanity, wandering off at official meetings into odd tangents about poisonous snakes, Sharpie pens, and his White House ballroom, and repeatedly calling Greenland Iceland while insisting it should belong to him. He appalled allies when he gloated that liberal Hollywood director Rob Reiner had been allegedly stabbed to death by his son and Nguyen after the death of former FBI director and special counsel Robert Mueller. He said, "Good, I'm glad he's dead." After Trump's genocidal threats against Iran, Democrats have called on the cabinet to invoke the 25th Amendment to remove Trump for mental unfitness, but he has surrounded himself with fawning loyalists, rendering that idea moot. "Trump's chest-thumping and semi-coherent bluster are nothing new," said Beckett Adams in National Review, "but now that he's started a war of choice in the Middle East, he's provided the added bonus of a ticking body count, including more than 3,600 Iranians and at least 13 Americans. It's fully reasonable to question why our president keeps teetering frantically between talk of peace and threats, promising terrible outcomes that no American has had time to consider, let alone endorse." "Trump haters may clutch at their pearls," said Hugo Gordon in the Washington Examiner, "but he has a long, successful track record of issuing bellicose threats and making outlandish demands to get the other side to the negotiating table. Hasn't anyone learned he should be taken seriously, not literally?" "Sorry," said Janan Ganesh in the Financial Times, "but it smacks of desperation to claim Trump is cleverly using Richard Nixon's madman theory to intimidate Iran into concessions. Trump's wild, irresponsible threats achieved next to nothing. Iran did not reopen the strait or surrender to his other demands." "All this is utterly exhausting for Americans and the world," said Sohrab Ahmari in Unheard. "Trump owes his presidency to voters who grew tired of technocrats such as Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama overriding the public will to make trade, economic, and immigration policy, often to the benefit of themselves and other elites. But Trump went into Mad King mode And the results make liberal technocrats look better by comparison. This is life under a personalist regime, said Lisa Needham in Public Notice, where all power is held by a cult-like leader not accountable to the military or to a political party. Trump reverses decisions based on nothing but whims. He demands that aides and followers show loyalty by agreeing to believe the same lies he does. When Congress and the Supreme Court simply step aside and abdicate their power, then it's all Trump all the time. Personalist government has brought us nonstop chaos, corruption, bitter division, and foreign conflict, and it's wrecking us. Artemis II, bringing awe to Earth. When the crew of Artemis II splashed down off the coast of San Diego, it felt as though the entire world was watching, said the Free Press in an editorial. Crowds gathered on California beaches. Children on the East Coast stayed up late for the broadcast. And millions of people across the planet waited for the safe return of the four astronauts who had ventured further into space than any human before them. Some 252,756 miles from Earth. The 10-day NASA mission captured the public's imagination in a way that no expedition has done in decades, perhaps because this was the first time since 1972 that humans have traveled around the moon. Or maybe it was the stunning images that the crew took of the moon's far side, with a blue-green Earth rising above the gray, pockmarked lunar surface. Or perhaps it was the very human moments we saw inside the 300-square-foot capsule, like when the crew embraced in a tearful group hug after naming a crater for Commander Reed Wiseman's late wife, Carol. These were not robots sent into the unknown. They were us. This mission was a reminder of the sheer vastness of outer space, said Ruth Graham in the New York Times. Many of us here on Earth became children at camp, lying supine and looking up at the stars thinking very big thoughts. And this was just a test flight for other giant leaps. The Artemis program aims to put astronauts back on the lunar surface by 2028. The science that makes such feats possible is spectacular, said Lisa Jarvis in Bloomberg. Yet the ability to do this kind of work has never felt so tenuous. The Trump administration last year slashed funding for federal scientific agencies, including NASA. And Trump's latest budget proposal, released 2 days after Artemis II blasted off, would shrink the space agency's funding by another 23%, or $5.6 billion. If that cut goes ahead, the U.S. won't be at the center of the next awe-inspiring event. Let's hope that never happens, because NASA has just shown us what truly makes America great, said Rick Wilson in his Substack newsletter. Not arrogance, not bluster. It's scientists, astronauts, and engineers spending years accumulating expertise and deploying it toward a goal that matters. Amid the chaos and dysfunction of the Trump administration, Artemis II reminded us that there is still an America that knows how to do hard things, that plans ahead, that checks its work. It's competency porn, and God, we are starving for it, dying for it. Satellites that rob the night of darkness. Plans to deploy giant reflective satellites in low Earth orbit could disrupt sleep, ecosystems, and food production on a global scale, leading scientists have warned. Several private companies have drawn up such plans. SpaceX wants to launch a million additional satellites to create an orbiting AI computing network. The California startup Reflect Orbital, meanwhile, wants to use satellite-mounted mirrors to redirect sunlight into areas of Earth on demand with brightness adjustable from that of the full moon to full noon. The main goal would be to allow solar farms to keep charging at night, but the technique could also be of use in emergencies for nighttime disaster response. The presidents of four international sleep and circadian rhythm societies, representing about 2,500 researchers across more than 30 countries, are urging the U.S. government to launch a full environmental review into both companies' proposals. They warn that a brighter night sky could disrupt biological clocks that regulate sleep and hormone secretion in humans and animals, migration in nocturnal species, seasonal cycles in plants, and the rhythms of marine phytoplankton that underpin ocean food webs. Existing satellites have already brightened the night sky by some 10%, reports The Guardian, and in another decade, the brightness could breach the level astronomers have set for preserving natural darkness. Plants need the night, said Charalambos Kiraso, head of the European Biological Rhythms Society. You can't just get rid of it. Hopes for arthritis sufferers. Researchers may be close to a cure for osteoarthritis, the painful wearing away of joints that affects 32 million Americans, reports the New York Times. Three teams funded by the federal agency ARPA-H have developed treatments that regrow bone and cartilage in animals. At Duke University, researchers created injections that stimulate cartilage cells to divide and remodel bone. A team at University of Colorado Boulder identified a repurposed drug that regenerated the knees of rabbits with a single injection, and engineers at Columbia University built a 3D printed scaffold filled with bone and cartilage cells that could potentially regrow an entire knee. All three approaches have so far been tested only in animals, but the teams are contractually required to begin testing in patients within 18 months. If any of them reach the market, they will cost just a quarter of the price of current treatments. It's hugely promising, said Scott Rodeo of the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York, who was not involved in the research. Right now, everything we have just modifies symptoms. Wit and wisdom. Liberty is meaningless where the right to utter one's thoughts and opinions has ceased to exist. This was from Frederick Douglass, quoted in the Dispatch. A diary is an assassin's cloak, which we wear when we stab a comrade in the back with a pen, according to Scottish writer William Soutar, quoted in the Wall Street Journal. This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. I'll be with you next week with The Week.